Thanks a lot, Dave. When you first announced I'll Fly Away and said you'd try to take it fast, I confused. When Lazarus went, he was carried by the angel. I don't think he picked the speed. But thanks for leading that. I figured out you were talking about the song. It's great to have you all back here with us tonight. Appreciate your interest in the Word of God. I've got my New Testament open to Matthew chapter 5. And I'd like to read verses 13 through 16 as we begin. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt hath lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out, and to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men, that they may see your good works, and glorify your Father which is in heaven. This is the picture our Lord gives of the function of the Christian in the world. Reduced to one word, it would be influence. The Christian who lives according to the Beatitudes the Lord just gave is going to influence the world as salt and light. All that a person does and says and is, the sum total of our character, consciously or otherwise, affects other people every day. No man is an island. The story is told in Greek mythology of a goddess who came unseen, but was always known by the blessings she left in her pathway. Trees blackened by forest fires put forth new leaves as she passed. In her footprints at the brookside, violets sprang up. The stagnant pool became a spring of sparkling water. The parched fields blossomed as the rose, and every hillside and valley blushed with new life and new beauty as she passed by. The story is also told of another beautiful princess who was sent as a present to a king. There was an atmosphere about her as sweet-smelling as the garments of Aphrodite. She seemed as beautiful and pure as if fresh from a bath of dew, and her breath was as the sweet perfume of the richest rose. But strange to tell, in the atmosphere she carried about with her was the contagion of death. From her infancy, this beautiful woman had known no food but poison. She had been reared on it and became so permeated with it that she herself became the very essence of it. She would breathe her fragrant breath into a swarm of insects, and behold, they would lie dead at her feet. She would place the loveliest flower upon her bosom, and it would fade and fall apart. Into her presence came a hummingbird. It fluttered, poised in the air for a moment, shuddered, and fell to the ground dead. How like this poisoned princess is every person that has an influence as a blight or a curse upon his fellow man. The atmosphere we exhale is richly laden with the fragrance of virtue or with a poisonous perfume that consumes the people around us. You're writing a gospel, a chapter each day, by deeds that you do and words that you say. Men read what you write, whether faulty or true. So, what is the gospel according to you? President Woodrow Wilson told this story. He said, I was sitting in a barber chair when I became aware that a man had entered the room. He came quietly in upon the same errand as myself to get his hair cut, and he sat in the chair next to me. Every word the man uttered, though not in the least didactic, showed a personal interest in the man who was serving him. Before I got through with what was being done for me, I was aware that I had attended an evangelistic service. I purposefully lingered in the room after he had left, and noticed the singular effect that his visit had brought on the barber shop. They talked in undertones. They didn't know his name, but they knew that something had elevated their thoughts. I felt as I left that place that I was leaving a place of worship. Influence. What message do you leave the world? When you pass by, what is it that you're saying? No human being can come into this world without either increasing or diminishing the sum total of human happiness, not only in the present, but in every subsequent generation of humanity. Nobody can detach himself from this connection, even if you want to. There's no sequestered spot in the universe. There's no dark niche along the disk of non-existence where we can retreat from our relationships with other people. There's no place we can go to withdraw the influence of our existence upon the moral destiny of the world. Everywhere, our presence or our absence will be felt. Everywhere, we will have companions who will be better or worse because of us. It's a statement of fathomless import that we are forming characters for eternity. And not only our own characters, but the characters of those people around us. That momentous fact lies in the responsibility of our existence. Who is sufficient for this thought that we have this kind of impact? Thousands of my fellow beings and yours will enter eternity with characters differing from those that they would have carried there if we had never lived. The sunlight of the next world will reveal my fingerprints and yours in the strata of its life and thought. That's what Jesus is teaching in that passage we read from Matthew 5, 13 through 16. He's talking about influence, how you and I affect the world. You who are characterized by beatitude quality life, you who are the sons and daughters of the kingdom of God, are the salt and light to the world to influence it for good and for God. And it isn't easy. Our Lord said in John 17, I don't pray that you take them out of the world. That's in verse 15. And the next sentence he says, they are not of the world. That's in verse 16. Two verses later he said, I have sent them into the world. And later on the Holy Spirit had John write, love not the world, neither the things that are of the world. These statements put together go like this. I want you in the world, but not of the world. I sent you to the world, but don't love the world. Does that feel like a thin line? Sometimes it does. In it, but not of it. Sent to it, but not to love it. So how are we to influence the world? The solution is to be salt and light. Salt, to be effective, has to be mingled with the substance it's affecting, and yet salt is still distinct from that substance. Light, to dispel darkness, must shine on the darkness and yet is distinct from the darkness. The Lord outlined the qualities and the principles that make us distinctive. We who are the beggarly ones, who mourn over sin, who are meek before our God, as he said in the Beatitudes, who hunger and thirst after righteousness, we who are merciful and pure in heart and peacemakers, as a result will be persecuted. That's the distinctiveness of our lifestyle. In verses 1 through 12 of this chapter, the Lord defines our character, and then he says, this is the character you must develop and then use to influence the world. As we live out the reality of the Beatitudes, we will affect the world. And the world will react negatively many times, but sometimes it'll react positively. I stood out on the steps today about 3 o'clock. Ron went by and honked a while ago. He told me that was him. I was glad to know who was honking at me in a bus, big old yellow bus. But I was just talking to the people as they passed by, inviting them to the meeting and talked to them about the Bible. Some react positively, some react negatively. But we're always going to have that kind of mixed result. The words about salt and light here come right after the part about being persecuted and about being reviled. You can anticipate that at some point, if you live a godly life, you will be persecuted in some way. And when that happens, don't think that it means that you need to change your function. Immediately, he says, don't forfeit your saltiness. You're still the light of the world. Don't mitigate, don't minimize, don't turn off or hide that light under a bushel. Don't let persecution alter your function in the world. Your influence is to be what God designed it to be. Somebody quoted in their class here on Sunday, yesterday morning, 1 Peter 2:9. You're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of God's own. For what purpose? That you should show forth the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. The reason that you are who you are in the kingdom is to manifest this influence. We cannot bend to the world. We cannot bow to the world. We do not alter our commitment. Like Luther, when confronted by those who were branding him as a heretic and wanting to take his life, his response was, well, I can't recant. I will not deny what is true. And that's our point as well. We're salt and light, and we're never to alter that function. we have to face the music, or in biblical terms, we have to take up the cross and follow Christ. So we don't crawl off to a monastery. We get out in the world and live it right there where they can see it. So in verses 10 through 12 of this chapter, we see the attitude of the world toward the Christian. And then in verses 13 through 16, which I read, we see the attitude of the Christian toward the world. The world is going to hate us in many cases, but we're still salt and light to influence them. Interestingly, the very people the world hates are the very ones that they desperately need to be influenced by. The quasi-religious, quasi-pious scribes and Pharisees who hated the Christians were dependent on the influence of the Christians to know the real truth about God. So the world may persecute us, but the world is really dependent on us being the manifestation of the gospel. Because we alone are the salt of the earth. Just us. There is no other salt of the earth. If we lose our saltiness, it's lost. We alone are the light of the world. Just us. Nobody else. If we hide our light under a bushel, there is no other alternatives. In this passage here, we see a presupposition made by the Lord, and then we see the plan that he unfolds for us. Then we see the problem that he's confronting, and we see the purpose that's behind all of this. And I hope to deal with all this. If I don't, I'll just stop when the time's up. But first of all, the presupposition that the Lord has. This text presupposes two things. It presupposes that the world is decayed. That's why it needs salt. It also presupposes that the world is dark. That's why it needs light. Jesus is looking out at the world and seeing its spoilation. He knew it needed salt to arrest its corruption. He saw them wrapped in gloom, sitting in darkness. He knew they needed light. The Lord's view of the world is that it's decadent and dark. One of Paul's epistles to Timothy says that evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse. The world of Jesus' time had the same decay and the same darkness that ours has. The time in between has allowed us to have more inventions of evil, as it was put in the book of Ecclesiastes and also in the Roman letter, chapter 1. You know, a little over 100 years ago, at the end of the 19th century, the philosophers and the poets who were writing then had an incredible sense of optimism about what was coming in the future. But they were just on the cusp of something great, as they thought. In the Emersonian era, the prevailing view was that we were headed into a golden age. We were going to go waltzing into utopia. Everything was going to be perfect. Every day, in every way, man is getting better and better. That was the cry of the time. And in the golden age to come, in the 20th century, they said, wars are going to be abolished. Nations will talk instead of fight. Disease is all going to be cured. Suffering is all going to be eradicated. Drunkenness is going to end. Vice is going to come to a halt. The earth is fast becoming a paradise. Needless to say, the books that they wrote don't sell too well in our day. Because the world is rotten, and we know it. And it's just as rotten with technology as it was without it, and maybe even a little worse. That is the biblical view of the world. That's the way Jesus saw it. In Genesis 1, God creates man. By Genesis 6, God says, all I see is evil continuing. The only thing to do is save 8 righteous people and drown the rest. And he did that, gave 8 people a new start on the earth. But by Genesis 19, Sodom and Gomorrah are so bad that the Lord had to destroy them. And of course, the time is coming when this whole earth will be destroyed in a holocaust like has never been seen. This is the same old story. Man just gets worse. There is no antidote apart from God. Man will not have God because he loves darkness rather than light. So the world continues to devolve, disintegrate, and descend. We've had so many peace talks, and the wars continue to rage because man wants power more than he wants peace. We've got lots of technology, but we still have problems we'll never solve. Slaughters and murders, rapes, child abuse, despair, pessimism. Man has not been able to stop his descent. And he has the sickening feeling that he's just speeding it up with his technology. And he's hoping that some little guy doesn't somewhere punch the wrong red button and blow us all up in a nuclear war. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. We have a decaying, corrupted society shrouded in darkness. Our society needs salt to retard the corruption and needs light to brighten the darkness. The presupposition is that darkness and decay is in the world, and that moves us to the second point, the Lord's plan. God has a plan. He set us up in this world as a kingdom of priests, as a holy nation. and our job is to retard the corruption and bring light to the darkness. The sad thing is that often, instead of the church influencing the world in this way, the church is influenced by the world and falls victim to all sorts of human trends. But the plan is, ye are the salt of the earth, ye are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men. In verses 13 and 14, actually the pronouns are quite emphatic there. You only are the salt. You only are the light. Nobody else. If you don't retard the corruption, if you don't bring light to bear on the world, then there will be no such retardation and no such light. And that's why we must not be corrupted by the world, but must remain distinct from the world. We can't swallow its morality or immorality or amorality or non-morality. We can't swallow its materialism, its self-centeredness. We can't listen to its philosophies. Our lives and our relationships and our homes have to be different. We're to come out from among them and be separate and touch not the unclean thing. This is a very exacting call. We are to stand and face the world emphatically, and having done all, stand. All who possess the character of the kingdom are the salt of the earth, both individually and collectively. You know, when was the last time that you asked somebody to pass the salt, and then you picked out of that just one little grain of salt, and you put that on your food, just one grain? Who uses one grain of salt? No, you use many grains of salt, and they work on your food collectively. You don't get just one grain. One grain functions in combination with other grains of salt. The church is collective salt. This plan takes all of us. When we are each salt, we are collective salt, and there is a cumulative influence. The light uses the illustration of a city. But obviously, the light of a city comes from many lights in their cumulative effect. Light is the combination of all that fluorescence. Many lights light a city, and many grains of salt affect a substance. We're obviously not all together most of the time, but we're still each salt and light all the time. And there is a collective effect. And the verb here stresses being, what we are and what we continue to be. We are salt and we continue to be salt, and the only salt of the earth. It's not that we should be salt, it's that we are. Like it or not, you are the salt of the earth. The only question is whether you're salty. The only question is whether you've lost your saltiness. You are the salt, and you either have that savor flavor or you don't. The idea isn't, oh, please be salt. The idea is, you are salt. The question is whether you're salty. You are light. The question is whether you're on or not. If you're a Christian, you're salt. If you're a Christian, you're light. You don't say, well, I'm a new Christian and I would like to someday attain unto salthood. No, that's not the idea at all. It's not that I'm growing toward being light. You are salt and you are light right now. Have you got the taste and shine? Jesus is the true light. And he passed that light along to us. And he said through the apostle in the Philippian letter, chapter 2, verse 15, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life. That's the purpose of it. Holding forth the words of life. That's our motto. Christ is the light, but we are also lights. He's the sun, and we are his reflecting moons. We were darkness, but now we're light. Ephesians 5:8, Paul goes so far to say, not just that you used to be in darkness, he says, you were darkness, but now you're light in the world. He says the same thing to the Thessalonians. You're not in darkness, you're in the light. Therefore, walk as children of day. We've been separated from the world. 1 John chapter 5, verse 4, whosoever is born of God overcomes the world. This is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. Paul said in the first chapter of the Colossian letter that you were translated out of the power of darkness and into the kingdom of God's dear Son. So reflecting the light of the sun, we are moons. We are salt to retard the corruption. We are light to manifest the truth. One is negative, the other is positive. By our influence, we retard corruption. Our salt influence may at times be silent, just as salt rubbed into meat to preserve it was silent. By our verbalization and our living, we manifest the truth. Our light influence is open and includes words of enlightenment. So we have both the silent influence and also the open and verbal influence. We have the influence of attitudes and deeds and words. Salt is unlikely It's not like the medium that it is placed in. Light is not like the darkness that it affects. God has changed us. It's a heart change from the inside out. He's changed us from being a part of the corrupting meat of the world to being the salt that can preserve it, and from being part of the gloomy darkness to being the light that can expose it. And I don't think there's any middle ground here. You're one or the other. You're either Peter or you're Judas. Everybody's got to decide who they're going to be. We are infected with this responsibility. There's nothing in the middle. You can't be part of the world system. We can't have people who claim to be Christians, but yet who never separate from the evil system. The Lord connects the blessedness of the Beatitudes with the responsibility of verses 13 through 16. And if you have that blessing, you have that responsibility too. The responsibility is to live as salt and light. It's challenging and it's exciting, but it's not easy. But it is vastly rewarding. You live above the world. You sprinkle the salt onto something from above. When you put salt on something, you do it from above. You shed light from above. It's God's divine plan that we think of ourselves in this way. You know, salt is a fascinating substance. In ancient times, it was extremely valuable. The Greeks actually considered salt divine. The only way to preserve the meat was to salt it. They would literally rub the salt into the meat. Some of you are old enough to remember doing that before we had a bunch of electricity around. When they traveled, they would either keep jerky soaking in brine or just salted and left hard. Salt is and was a preservative. Roman soldiers were actually paid with salt. That's where our word salary comes from. And if you were a lousy soldier, you weren't worth your salt. And that's how that phrase came into our language. Salt was a sign of friendship. There were salt covenants. In some societies, people still take a pinch of salt and throw it over their shoulder when they make a promise. In 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 5, God speaks of a covenant of salt that he made with David. This was similar at that time to using a notary public in our time. When you wanted to authenticate the legality of a document, the two entering the covenant would eat salt in the face of witnesses, and the witnesses would testify that the covenant was binding. God prescribed salt as necessary part of the sacrifices, partly to be a preservative. Leviticus 2:13, every oblation of your meat offering shall be seasoned with salt. Neither shall you suffer the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your meat offerings. With all your offerings you shall offer salt. So salt was a very, very important commodity. When Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth," and they heard just that phrase, they could have thought about a lot of things because they were so familiar with salt. They could have thought that Jesus was saying that they were valuable because he called them salt. Salt was used to season food. Food without salt has something missing, doesn't it? A lot of times people have a terrible time when they have to go on a salt-free diet because they really like salt. And the book of Job says in chapter 6, verse 6, "Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? Is there any taste in the white of an egg?" That's in the Bible. Is there any taste in the white of an egg? What a difference there is between an egg with salt and an egg without salt. So they could have thought of this seasoning idea when they heard this expression. In Ezekiel 16, there's an interesting use of salt at the birth of a baby. You know, the whole chapter is about God's relationship with Israel through the figure of a woman who is originally born as a baby girl. In verse 4, "As for thy nativity, in the day when thou wast born, thy navel was not cut, neither wast thou washed with water to supple thee. Thou wast not salted at all, nor swaddled at all." Wait a minute. The baby wasn't salted? What are they going to do? Eat this baby? What's this all about? You know what they used to do? They would, when a baby was brand new born, they would wash the baby and then rub salt all over the baby, and the salt would be dissolved by the water they just washed the baby with. And in the process of the birth, there might have been nicks or scratches, and that salt would act as a healing agency for the baby and be good for the skin. And the point here was that a baby that was not salted at birth was considered neglected. But salt could also serve a destructive purpose. In the book of Judges, chapter 9, verse 45, "After Abimelech had captured Shechem, he salted their fields as a punishment." And obviously you couldn't grow anything there after that, with the possible exception of asparagus. And I don't know if they knew about asparagus and how much asparagus loves salt. A lot of people in Iowa don't know about that. I'm not sure why, but yeah, obviously you do. You're nodding your heads about that. You couldn't grow any crops there, though. This was such an egregious thing that that's the only time in the Bible this was ever done. For people to have their fields salted, and you just couldn't grow anything there at all. Later on, the Romans did the same thing with Carthage in Africa, which had been such a thorn in their side. But you can see how this statement, "You are the salt of the earth," could have taken people's minds in a lot of directions, and several understandings of it were possible. Let me just mention to you a few of the things that the commentators suggest on this, and then I'll tell you the one that I think is best. I've already alluded to it a little bit. Something that Jesus had purity in mind here, since salt is white, the symbolic color of purity. Some people think Jesus was connecting verse 8, "Blessed are the pure in heart," with the idea of salt here. And certainly we are to be examples of purity. We're to hold up God's standard in our thoughts and speeches and action. But when Jesus talked about whited sepulchers, he wasn't talking about purity, even though he used white there. The whiteness there didn't have a good connotation at all. So if he is connecting purity with the whiteness of salt here, I don't think that's his main point. Another thought among the commentators is that he's talking about flavor. You are the flavor of the world. Without you, the world would be tasteless. And I agree that there's a sense in which we flavor the world. Somebody pointed out as they were walking in a while ago that in the church we really do have a lot of fun. And I agree with that. We do. But I don't think the world thinks of us as salt in that manner. I think the world in general think that we make the world more tasteless. They have connected with Christianity with that which takes the flavor out of life. How many times have you heard somebody say, "Oh, I don't want to be a Christian, you can't do anything"? Like Swinburne in his poem about the Messiah, "Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean, the world has grown gray from thy breath." That's quite a statement. You have lulled the world into a state of gray. Although there is a sense in which we are symbols of purity in the world, and we do flavor the world, I don't think that's quite dead center on what the Lord's thought is here about the salt of the earth. A third possible option is that salt stings. Salt has medicinal healing properties when put into a wound. Some would say Christians are not to be honey to soothe the sinful world. We are to be salt in the wound of the world to get the world's attention and heal and cleanse the world. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 15 and 16 says that we are unto God a sweet savor of Christ, unto them that are saved, and unto them that perish. To the one we are the savor of death unto death, and to the other the savor of life unto life. In other words, we're to be honey to the believers, but be confrontational salt to the unbelievers. And there are times when we need to, as salt, get into the wounds of the world. There are times that I have to say, "No, I'm sorry, I can't marry you because you don't have a right to marry." I almost got my nose broken saying that one night. Salt stings in the wound. But I don't think that's all there is to this idea of the Lord talking about we are the salt of the earth here. Another function of salt is to create thirst. Salt in your body creates thirst and makes you drink the fluids that you need in order to rehydrate your body and survive. Without salt in the food, there would be an improper intake of liquid, and when there's an improper intake of liquid, there's dehydration causing sickness or even death. This was particularly true in that desert society, those countries around the land where the Lord was speaking at this time, at the Sea of Galilee, giving the Sermon on the Mount. Working outside in the summer, how many of you used to take salt tablets back when that was popular back in the 50s and 60s? We'd take salt tablets when we'd sweat outside so that our bodies would be replenished from what we had lost through perspiration. Sometimes people say, and you've probably noticed this in your life, people will say to you, "What is it that you've got? How can you have such peace in this situation or that? Where does your contentment flow from in your life as I'm seeing it?" they will say. So that's creating a thirst. Salt will do that. Now, they may not like our theology, they may not want our Jesus, but they do see in us a lifestyle that makes them sometimes thirst for what Jesus brings. Is that what Jesus was talking about here? Well, he may have meant elements of all of these possibilities. We certainly ought to be pure and white in the world and flavor it and sting the world at times. We should make the world thirsty for God because our lives are rich and full. But I personally think that the key reason we're called salt is this fifth one that I'll mention to you, and that is that salt is a preservative. I think this is his main point here. They rubbed salt into the meat to saturate it and therefore to preserve it. We are an antiseptic preservative in the world to retard the spread of its corruption. You know, if it were not for Christians in the world would be far more corrupt than it is right now. We are preserving the world. We live a holy, Christ-like character in the world, and We are white, and we do flavor it, and we do sting it sometimes and make it thirsty. All of that in combination is added to the fact that we preserve the world from going completely corrupt. We check the rottenness and the decay of the world. And he's saying here that the only way we'll ever do this is if our salt still has its savor. This has confused a lot of people. Our presence in the world is to hold back crime. Our presence in the world changes certain kinds of conversation when we come into the room. Have you noticed that at work? Probably have. Our conversation, our being present, ought to change barbershops and locker rooms. We ought to pass through the world the way that goddess did. And everywhere we step, flowers symbolically bloom. That's what he's talking about here. Our presence should condemn apostasy. Our presence should affect the way people think. It's amazing how people can alter their conversations sometimes when some of you just come around in the workplace. You know, in Genesis 18:23, the Lord was making his decision and bringing Abraham in on it. Abraham said, "Are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" You don't want to wipe out the righteous with the wicked. What if there are 50 righteous people down there? God said, "I'll spare them for the sake of 50. You know the story well. Abraham said, "Well, I'm just dust and ashes, but I have taken it upon myself to speak. What if there are 45? Won't destroy it for the sake of 45. So he got the Lord down to 40 and 30 and 20. "Please, Lord, don't be angry. What about 10? "I won't destroy it for the sake of 10. Just 10 righteous people in that whole valley where there were five cities, Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboam and the little city of Zoar. If he could find 10 righteous, that's only two per town. If he could have found two righteous people per town, all that would have been saved and the fire and brimstone would have been held back. Just two righteous people per town." Christians in the world preserve the world from the wrath of God. We are an agency to delay God's inevitable judgment. And if we're going to do that, we can't live the way the world lives. We're in the world, yet different. In the world, yet separate. We're the only salt of the whole earth, as indwelt by the Spirit of God. We're the only restraint in the rotting carcass of humanity. And it's just amazing to me, and I'm sure to you, how God uses something as humble and basic as us. God gives noble purposes to ignoble things. When God made man in the beginning, he didn't use silver or gold. He didn't even use iron to make us. He used dirt. When he used David to deliver Israel from the Philistines, he didn't use Saul's kingly armor. He used a slingshot and a little rock. When Jesus came, he didn't enter a family of wealth and nobility. He came to a peasant girl and was born in a manger. When he chose the 12, he didn't choose elite, affluent, wealthy men, educated men, but unlearned and ignorant Galileans. Not many wise, not many mighty, not many noble are called. That's the way it's always been. God declares you and me, meager though we be, to be the salt of the earth. He wants to use us to hold back the judgment of the world and retard the corruption until every possible last person that is going to be saved can be saved. And God gets the greater glory in the humbleness of the ones he uses. Salt and light balance one another. Salt is more hidden. It just melts away into whatever it flavors or preserves. But light shines on the outside. Light is open. Light works visibly. We affect society's thinking and living by both of these powers in our lives. We turn on the light so everybody can see the message that we want to give. And it isn't just in our words, but it's our overt, openly godly conduct. We are both a subtle influence like salt and a blatant influence like light. Salt can't change corruption into incorruption. Salt can only retard the corruption. That's a negative function. Salt holds back the corruption. We have to shine the light of the gospel to transform corruption into incorruption. So it takes both, the positive, the negative, and the positive. So he says in verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." That implies that they have heard something about our Father which is in heaven. It implies both a life and a message lived and spoken. Which is more important, the Christian life or the Christian lip? The Christian walk or the Christian talk? I think they're like the two wings of an airplane. If you don't have them both, you're not going to get off the ground. Here's an interesting thing. In the first verse of the book of Acts, Luke writes, "The former treatise have I made, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began both to do and to teach." It takes both. Doing and teaching. Ever and always, those two go together. The living and the speaking. Living the righteous life and speaking the truth in love. God is light, and if we are light, we manifest God. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. God is light. Thy word is light. Christ is the light that lights every man. First John, Gospel of John 1:9. That is the light that we shine on the world. We tell about God. We tell about God's word. We tell about God's Christ. So 2 Corinthians 4 verse 6 comes into play. God, who first ordered the light to shine in the darkness, has flooded our hearts with his light. We can enlighten people only because God has enlightened us. God passes the light down through us. Philippians 2:14. Do all things without murmuring and disputing, that you may be blameless and harmless, children of God, without rebuke. Why is this so important? Because of our influence. If they're going to criticize us, let them have to make something up, because there's nothing true they can use. If we have to be hated, let's be hated like Christ, hated without a cause. Blameless, harmless, children of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life. That light has to shine openly. A city that's set upon a hill cannot be hid. You know, their villages were built mainly on hilltops, on the tops of hills. That only not gave them better breezes, but they also could be more easily defended on the tops of hills. So when night came and everybody lit a lamp in their house, it just made the village sparkle. And anybody walking along through the night in the darkness between towns could easily find the village, because the light sparkled like diamonds in the sky. A city could not be hid. Light was for the purpose of shining forth openly. So we're not just subtle salt. We are very conspicuous light. We're not Masons in a secret society. We're not pagans with mysteries only for the initiated. We don't have a cult known only to a few. We're a city set upon a hill, and the whole world ought to see us. That's the Lord's plan. What's the problem? The problem is that if sin enters our lives and we don't walk in the Spirit, we're going to stop being effective as salt and light and be useless. If the salt has lost its saltiness, what good is it? Non-salty salt has no use. It's good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men. Neither do men light a lamp and put it under a bushel, but on a lampstand it gives light to all that are in the house. There is no place for the secret Christian. Well, now that you've had this new job for 2 years, how do you like it? What did they say there when they found out you were a Christian? Well, they haven't found out yet. That's ridiculous. They ought to know you're a Christian from the beginning. Just because of the way you live, the way you talk, the way you think, and what's on your mind, what comes out of your mouth. There are no clear-all Christians where only God knows for sure. We've got to be open about this. Now, salt can lose its saltiness. And as I said a moment ago, a lot of people have been confused about this point. The Greek word here means flat and tasteless. But the explanation of this is that in Jesus' day, the salt that they used was not nearly as refined as our salt is today. And so this happened, salt losing its saltiness, happened more often back in those times. The Dead Sea was, as it is today, a tremendous repository of salt. Salt was in abundance. Some of you have been there. Salt was and is in abundance in the marshes and lagoons and on the rocks of the Dead Sea. Because this salt was mixed with gypsum and therefore impure, it could easily acquire a stale or aquiline taste. That kind of salt would soon lose its capacity to salt. And the only thing it was good for was to throw out on the road where people walked. You couldn't throw it on the fields or it would kill everything. So they threw it on the road where it would be trampled. Natural salt is impure in many cases, and this is the point. It's mixed with other chemicals and can become unsalted. In fact, William Thompson, in his book, The Land and the Book, which is a very valuable, it's a real old book, but there's a lot of value to that book. He deals with the land of Israel in the book, and he tells there of a merchant who rented several houses in which he stored salt, but he forgot to cover the dirt floor in these houses before he put the salt down. And when he returned later, he found that the salt had lost its flavor from being next to the earth. So he threw the whole supply out into the street where it was trampled, just exemplifying what the Lord was talking about here. The point is that the kind of salt they used in New Testament times when Jesus was talking could lose its saltiness. That's what the Lord's talking about here. Luke 14, verse 34, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its savor, with which shall it be seasoned? It's neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. I mention this, and I'm stressing it, because it's amazing how many commentators say that Jesus was wrong here because salt can't lose its saltiness. But in Jesus' day, salt, as they knew it, could lose its saltiness, and his point is that we can lose ours too. If sin begins to dominate in our lives, we lose our saltiness, and with it, our influence for good. You can't retard the corruption of the world at that point then, because you're of the world. There's nothing to distinguish you from the world. You're just like them. You forfeit your influence, you lose your impact, and if you continue, you become a castaway. If you've worked your job a long time and they know you're a Christian there, they know your reputation, just start being sinful at work and see how rapidly your reputation goes away. If you're sinful at school, you will soon lose your saltiness. And make no attempt then, make no contribution to retard the corruption. It's true that perfectly pure salt will not ever lose its flavor. That's true. Our problem is that none of us is perfectly pure salt. While we're in this world, we're going to have impurities. And our potential for losing our saltiness is always going to be there as long as we're in this world. The lamps that they used in those days were little terracotta-type lamps with a spout on one end and a handle on the other and a wick floating in the middle of the oil. They would let them burn often all night long. The Proverbs 31 lady, remember? The lady in Proverbs 31, her candle goeth not out by night. You have to keep enough oil and you have to be conscientious enough to keep it trimmed and lit. So we've got this treasure in earthen vessels, although some Christians are like an Arctic river, frozen at the mouth. But we've got this treasure in earthen vessels. Jesus was calling for something new here. This was transformative. He's telling these people, your part in Judaism, your part of a religious system that has really gotten fouled up. And if you live according to the character of my kingdom, then you're really going to be different from the people around you. The fear of persecution makes us hesitant, whether it's subtle persecution or overt persecution. In verse 16, he personalized this. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. There is such a beauty, such an attractiveness, such a winsomeness in good deeds. People notice it if you go out of your way to do something nice for them. They don't have that happen real often in general. So he says, let the world see my beauty in you. The light is in you now. You don't have to crank it up. You don't have to worry about getting it started. All you have to do is let it go. Christ already lives in you. He already is the light. All you got to do is let it shine. Won't let Satan it out. I'm going to let it shine. If you got a basket of fear over that light, if you got a basket of wanting to be acceptable over the light, if you got a basket of not wanting to offend people or not wanting to make waves, just take the basket off and let the Lord shine by the things you do, the things you say. The final purpose of all of this is the glorification of God, that they may glorify your Father which is in heaven. If that isn't your priority, to glorify your Father which is in heaven, then you're more concerned with yourself than you are with God's glory. If your top priority is the glory of God, you will be that salt that is salty, and you will be that light that is manifest. Those people 2,000 years ago needed to hear the basics just like we do 2,000 years later. We who know the Bible still need the same old story. What about your influence? What's it like? What happens when you walk by? We need to live and talk so that the world can see who God is and that we belong to Him. Today, somebody passed into the next world. Tomorrow, more will pass into the next world. Happens all the time. Never stops. If you were to die tomorrow, would it be said that you made a difference in this world? Sweep through the world as salt and light and make a difference. And don't expect it to be easy. Truth be told, it's probably going to get harder, not easier. Probably is. I heard a commentator on TV saying, you know, no matter who's elected, it's going to get worse, so be sure you get out there and vote. You know, what kind of hope is there in that? I mean, this isn't where our hope is. It's probably going to get harder, not easier. But just because the world makes it hard on us, you shouldn't hide and you shouldn't keep your mouth shut. God's plan is us. And the way we change the world is not to change it politically. It's not to rewrite the laws. It's not to get out and march. It's not to use technological paraphernalia for altering society. The way we change the world is to infiltrate it with godliness, righteousness, and holiness and affect it from inside out. Those other things I mentioned aren't wrong. They're just powerless to change the world. The way to do it is the influence of godly people. Have you ever wondered why England did not have a revolution at the end of the 18th century the way France did? France had an amazing revolution that blew the top off the pressure cooker, and people have been talking about the French Revolution ever since. Why didn't England have a revolution like that? It's because the people in England were different from the people in France. The masses of people in England were living a different life from those in France. They had a different outlook. So the whole political situation was affected by the people, the way the people were. Jesus looked out at the city of Jerusalem and he wept, saying, "How often I would have gathered you, but you would not." Let's not cause more tears for the Lord because we too have been unfaithful. May we live to fulfill this marvelous command. May God make us different, that the world may be different because we're different. It appears that God may call upon those of us living in this 21st century and days ahead to stand up and be counted for his cause in real ways that we have not been forced to do in the past. It appears that that's possible. It was said in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, as many of you know, that you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. You haven't yet. Well, we haven't yet either so far. We haven't been martyred yet. But that could very feasibly happen. We used to talk about that theoretically. Now, it may feasibly happen during a lifetime of some who are here. I don't know what the future holds, but I know that we need to come to grips with our true intentions right now. We've got one life. We've got one shot. You've chosen Christ. You love Christ. His word has penetrated your heart, and there is a price to pay. He paid the supreme price for us. He bore the blows that should have been blown by us. We can take the blows that the world means for us. We're the only salt and light. So let's be different and let's make a difference. And we extend the invitation to any who are outside of Christ to join us in this worthy, mighty cause as we stand together and sing the invitation out.